Well, we're beginning four lectures on digital filters. If you think the lectures are on the topic of digital filters, they're going to be pretty dull. If you think the four talks on digital filters are a device to hang a great many stories on, then it's a different thing. And that's what it really is. I can't tell you stories in detail about how people do research, except about myself. It isn't polite, and furthermore, I really cannot get data on other people, how Einstein did things. Most people don't really get down to the nitty-gritty of how things go. So I'm forced to do this, talking about myself, and you'll find, I think, that I am trying to underline a couple of points. One is, if you will do a little extra work each time and get down to fundamentals and study things until you understand them, then Pasteur's remark, luck favors the ignorant mind, will favor you. That's really what's going on. So let me start first with the history behind my involvement in digital filters. I had a vice president, W.O. Baker, who I very much admired, but in all my years there, I was never in his office, and I don't think he ever came to mine. We would meet in the hall, and we would talk briefly. One time I met him, I said, Bill, when I came to Bell Labs in 46, we were going from relays to electronic central offices. And there were a large number of old relay people who would not learn to use oscilloscopes or anything else like that. They were moved over to a location I mentioned where. And I said, to you, they were an economic loss because they had to get on the way. And to me, they were a social loss because they were very disgruntled and unhappy. But I went on. During the war, Bell Labs had developed a military location, analog gun directors and plotting boards and everything else. There were a great many expert analog people. When we came into digital machines, I watched a large number of analog people unwilling to convert. And I said, the same thing happened. They had been pushed aside, walked around, and evaded, and they're an economic loss to you, and they're a social loss to me because some of my friends are not really happy. And I went on and said, you and I know, and this was back in the early 70s, the telephone company is going to go digital as fast as it can. If we do not now lay down books and other things so people can convert when they're young, we will have even more people intellectually lost because of change and socially unhappy. Because when the world passes you by, you are not a happy person. Well, he looks me square in the eye, and he says, yes, Hammy, you should, and walks off. Oh, I don't like digital filters. I don't know anything about it. But as I walk back to my office, I say, do I wisely ignore my vice president's remark? And in any case, even if he hadn't said it, considering the arguments I gave, should I neglect the importance of this topic? Obviously, I should do something about it. So I went to my friend Bill, Jim Kaiser, who I knew moderately well at that time, and said, Jim, you are the world's expert on digital filters. You wrote your doctoral thesis on it and so on, and you've done all kinds of work. There comes a time in people's career when they should stop and summarize it, write a definitive book that gets it all down, where people can find the whole thing instead of scattered in 25 different papers. And he allowed I was right. And I said, fine. Why don't you write a book? He said, well, okay. I started monitoring it. He wasn't doing anything. I started fussing at him. Nothing. I finally said to Kaiser, tell you what. We'll go to lunch together four times a week at least in a restaurant. And you will teach me digital filters, plus a little bit in your office. And I'll write the first part, and you can write the advanced part. And we'll call it Kaiser and Hammond. He said, fine. So I start learning digital filters from him, and there's quite a few stories I can tell you about crazy things that happened. And I will tell you a number of them. But he isn't writing anything. I finally say to him, hey, Jim, if you don't write more, we're going to call Hammy and Kaiser. He says, fine. When this stuff is finally done, I say to Jim, you have not written one word. I'll call Hammy. I'll thank you in the preface. He says, fine. We're still good friends. So that's how I came to write the book. It was because of social conscience that something needed to be done. I did not want to do it. I tried to get out of it. I could not get out of it. I did that which needed to be done. But let me tell you, jump ahead of it, what are consequences? I started well into the writing. I phoned up UCLA, summer division, extension courses. I said, hey, wouldn't you like a course on digital filters next summer? Because I wanted to get some debugging and going through the notes before I turned it into a book. I want to go practice. They said, fine. Well, I would say for maybe 10 or 15 years, I went out to Los Angeles, week or 2 weeks, sometimes I taught two courses, to give a course. And each time, they paid me $5,000 about, or a couple times more. But because it was popular there, I have given the course in Paris, in London, at Cambridge, England, at Nova Scotia, at Toronto, and in innumerable places in the United States, generally at the price of $5,000 for a week. Not bad for something you didn't want to do. Furthermore, the book has gone through three editions, and I haven't any idea how much I've made, but it must be a comfortable amount that's gone through three editions. If you do that which society wants and needs, society frequently recognizes it and repays you somewhat. So one of the lessons is you don't always do what you want to do. You do what you believe needs to be done and needs badly. So that's one of the consequences. Now, let's go back to the learning business. I'm a mathematician, basically. I discovered immediately that they were always using Fourier series to fit functions throughout electrical engineering, as you know. I said, oh, any complete set of functions, Bessel functions, vacuum functions, any complete set of functions will represent as anywhere else any set of functions you want. Any continuous function will represent just as well one set as another, practically. Why always the frequency approach? Well, you know, Kaiser, great expert he was, and he's a very smart man, but he didn't answer. I asked a bunch of other ones. One electrical engineer said, well, you know, alternating current is sinusoidal. That's why we use sinusoids. I said, you're out of your mind if you think it's got anything to do with signal processing. Well, I don't know how much you people know. If I really put it to you, why do you use those instead of other ones? I'd give you the answer, but it took me a long while to find them. If you want time-invariant system, such that whether I do it today or tomorrow, I will get essentially the same result, then the eigenfunctions of translation are indeed the sines and cosines, or preferentially the complex exponentials. Second, if you have a linear system, dynamic one, the eigenfunctions are, again, the complex exponentials. I finally extracted those out of books, but I also extracted a third one, which is going to be important. We are going to sample equal spaces. From the samples, we already want to reconstruct the function. If, as I will show you in a few minutes, I have equal space data and I have a pure sinusoid of high frequency, it will be aliased into a pure frequency of low frequency. One sinusoid will go into one sinusoid. That's not true of polynomials. If I have a high degree polynomial, say degree 15, and I sample 10 points and try to extract a ninth degree polynomial going through it, the relation is going to be very, very messy with the coefficients. High degrees of x don't go into low degrees of x under sampling equal spaces. But for sinusoids, they do. So those are three reasons why. Now, let me remind you what an eigenfunction is. You have a system, you put it in, it emerges exactly the same, scaled by some factor. You had that when you took differential equations. You had that when you took linear algebra. It had matrices. They were the same thing. Very, very common idea. Well, when I put in a frequency into a network theory, what do I get? What you learned is a transfer function. I said, but isn't really what we're talking about the eigenfunction? I tried on a lot of engineers. All I got was, well, yes, if you want to call them eigenfunctions, you are, the transfer function is the eigenfunction, but we call it the transfer function. I said, well, why have two names for the same thing? The students have already had it in two courses. Why change the word? Have it. So the famous transfer function that you have is nothing else than the eigenvalue of the corresponding eigenfunctions. Pure and simple. It took me a long while to follow those fundamentals. Next, I want to go on to sampling. Let's see, I used. If I have a frequency, now, I've got to back up. You will sample at very many different rates. But we're going to sample at equal spaces because that's what you can build equipment for and that's what you do almost all the time. I will immediately make a transformation so I'm sampling at unit times. 0, 1, 2, 3, 4. Thus, whether you're working in microseconds or in years, I will have the same equations. And therefore, I will be able to see what you are talking about microseconds and what some economists are talking about years is the same thing once I bring it down. So I'm always sampling t equals 0, 1, and if you want some negative values, all right, I'm sampling at the integers. Well, this is, as you know, cosine pi, 2 pi, n, and we call it some other number, n, k, we'll say. Kt sine 2 pi at, oh, cosine, minus sine sine. Well, the sine will be 0. The other one will be 1. That any integer multiple will always drop out. And I will have, this will be equal 1, and I will have the cosine. So that if I sample a high frequency equal space, I will get a lower frequency out. Right? In fact, I can get all the way down to the A could be 0 and 1, or if I want to write A, if A is bigger than a half, I write 1 minus A in place of A. I can get the interval from minus a half less than equal to the frequency A less than 1/2. The endpoints we can argue about some other day. Now this is Nyquist's theorem, old man Harry Nyquist, who also, remember, did several mechanisms of stability. A great man who could do two things. You don't meet him very often. He was a very nice guy and a very smart guy, but he had his goofy ideas too. What I am saying is that all high frequencies, when I sample, become a frequency in that interval. We can argue about the endpoints in a moment. It is the act of sampling. Now, Chucky called it aliasing. A high frequency alias under a low frequency. It goes under a different name. Now, network people usually carry all those high frequencies along, but I said to myself, once I have sampled, I have only low frequencies left. I cannot find those high frequencies unless I have outside information. Now, I went over this thing back and forth and roundabout and looked at the end values and so on and understood what happened to the end values. If I had assigned the highest frequency, or the lowest one, you'd get all zeros. So you couldn't tell what amplitude the sine was. So the sine term can't be worked. Now, I want to say something else about what probably your professor didn't tell you. When I work in sine and cosine, I have a pair of eigenfunctions. The sine and cosine, and I have only an interval here to zero up there. So I have two functions. When I use a complex exponential, I have one. Now, in the real case, zero the constant term, is a single eigenvalue, and all the rest in sine and cosines are double eigenvalues. Whereas if I go to complex ones, they're all uniformly a single eigenvalue. And that explains to you, really, if you study very hard, why it is that electrical engineering e to the ix works so much better than cosines plus sine. It works out much better, remember? Oh, we magic everything out much easier. That's the reason behind it all. It's a simpler eigenvalue representation. Well, I want to dwell on this point. The sampling produces this aliasing. It is an artifact of sampling. A high frequency will appear as a low frequency. And you can do it any number of ways. It's a trigonometric identity. You can draw a high frequency and sample a low rate, and you'll see it's equivalent to a low frequency. It's any number of ways of doing it. The simplest one is a trig identity. No more, no less. Well, I got it finally into my head. And you have to have two samples for the highest frequency present, and at the end, you can't do it. You have to have at least two samples for the highest frequency present. Now, let me digress and tell three stories about how, merely knowing that, I did useful things. The first one was I got trapped in doing a 28th order system of ordinary differential equations, which was simulating a Navy intercept plane coming in on a target. Now, I've got to know the step spacing I'm going to use in my integration numerically in order to know how many steps I'm going to do. They want 25 trajectories, and they know roughly in real time how long they would be. Some of them are longer flights than others. I have that information, what flights they want me to simulate. If I have to take a step size twice as small, computation is twice as big. But well, I have to give them a reasonable estimate. I finally give an estimate. It turns out $25,000. I think I can do the job. Fine, they say, here's the money, let's see you do it. And I spent a good piece of 1 year, and the lady worked well, we spent the whole of a year trying to get those answers. But what size? The theory of all the differential equations methods you know of will express the step size in terms of the fifth derivative or something. With 28 equations, who is going to tell me any reliable fifth derivative? No way. But you see, when I'm calculating the solution of a differential equation, I am calculating samples, equal spaces. So I go to them and say, hey, because of the sampling theorem, if there's high frequency, I'm going to have to sample very fine. If there's low frequency, I can take a big step. What is the highest frequency I have to worry about? They went back and retreated, and next week they come around and said, well, 10 cycles. If there's anything above 10 cycles, we'll worry about, but you better take care of everything below 10 cycles per second. Well, that tells me I got to have some sampling rate. Now, if I had samples from minus infinity to plus infinity, this applies. I certainly don't have them from minus to plus. I've got only samples up to now, so that's roughly a factor of 2 off, so I must have something like 4. Furthermore, I'm only using my formulas to calculate the next point. Again, only a few old values. I thought it must be something like 8. Do I know? So I did the obvious. One, I took the second order differential equation, y second plus y equals 0, and took the initial derivative, which gives the cosine, and started calculating for various step sizes how accurate I could get it. Next, I sat in my office with paper and pencil, and I derived theoretically what it would be. And lo and behold, the two agreed. At 7 samples per step size, I was getting reliably something like 4 or so figures per step. Now, of course, they don't know the weight of an airplane or something exactly to the pound. They don't have 6-figure accuracy of anything. So I don't have to calculate too accurately. 7 seemed marginal. 10, quite safe. For any accuracy they knew, I was perfectly safe with 10. So I gave the bid. Well, when we finally get the program going, $8,000 of programming costs into the business, because we're programming absolute binary. I asked the girl to run the thing at 1/120th of a second. I figured 70 is about safe. but merely. She does. I ask her to run the same thing again at 160th. The solution is no good. It's a mess. It doesn't resemble them. I ask her to run at 180th. The answer at 180th, 120th, agree pretty well. So I say to myself, my theory has been verified. So there you have the sampling theorem alone enabled me, with some thinking and a little other things, to calculate this important question, how much is it going to cost to solve your differential equations? What sampling rate must I use? The second story goes, a friend of mine has just come back from the West Coast, and he says to me, Douglas, who's a subcontractor, is using a hundredth to ten thousandth, a thousandth to a ten thousandth of a second step size in order to launch a Nike missile. I laugh right in the spot and say that's absolutely ridiculous. If he's using that, using a ten thousandth of a second step size, he's worrying about 1,000 vibrations per second. Well, the stick model he's using couldn't possibly support that. The atmosphere doesn't have that. If he'd been following the vibrations of the frame, yes. But not an airplane like that with the stick model he has. So my friend says, why? And I explained to him exactly everything I told you now, the sampling rate being what it is, and the vibration being the kind of thing it is. They're off. They're crazy by something like a factor of 100. Well, he goes back out. He says they're wrong. They look into it. They have a number in the register over 7 bits. 120 times too large. They're calculating the wrong problem. 100 times more expensive than needed. Debug across the continent. Right? The third one concerns here. I was here, and I was dealing with a very nice guy down the hall who was very smart, and he left. And his replacement wasn't right. I'm not going to name names, because he left too. He comes into my office one day and talks about sampling and the trouble they're having. And what they're doing is they're taking a very high-frequency signal, modulating it down, sampling, and trying to go ahead and calculate what that signal is. So let's go back to this and see what that thing is. If I imagine frequencies, and that's the place where the frequencies start being aliased, this curve becomes more, this point comes from there, this point comes from there, this point comes from there, and so on. All these points here are algebraically added here. That's where it goes across. Well, I tell you, you know, you really don't need to do this stuff. He knows the sampling theorem, and I look in the square in the eye and says, I know the sampling theorem better than you do. After all, I'm old gold Harry Nyquist. So after some more arguments, I beat him down to the following simple observation. If he has out here signal, and elsewhere there is none, and if this is brought back, shall we say, to here, from here to here, then the act of sampling will demodulate the signal back down to low frequency. Right? We have hot arguments over that for another day. Finally, the man agrees to try it. He removes this huge rack of demodulation equipment. The thing runs better. If your signal will fall in one of these bands out here, then sampling will demodulate down immediately, and you're down where you can play with it. Because at those high rates, you can't calculate anything. You have to calculate so many steps, you'll spend all your life getting nothing. You bring it up. Now, if that thing falls in a band like this, where the high is this end and the low is that, then, of course, the frequency are going to change. And Bell Labs did the following. They took the voice, modulated way up, and then sampled to bring it back down in reverse order. So whatever you spoke, what was high frequency was low, what was low frequency was high. And it was kind of hard to understand what a person said. But they tried it with music and various other things. They had a great deal of fun. You can do these things if you understand the sampling theorem. Now, these are three stories only illustrating what I told you. If you will understand fundamentals, like what that actuating thing is, understand how to do the sampling, then luck favors the prepared mind. This guy finally got a patent on this on radio and so on. He's going to be modulated by that method. He didn't know what he was doing, so he never really made paid much on it. Now, you know modulation, which I don't need to discuss, is multiplied by a frequency, a cosine of a frequency, and you get a product of two cosines is half the cosine of a half, of some plus cosine of half the difference. No, cosine of the sum of the cosine of the difference. Half cosine of sum plus cosine of difference is the cosine cosine. So if I take your low cosine frequency multiplied by a high frequency cosine, I'll get two frequencies. And if I drop the lower one, I have all the information in the higher band. That means, and it's almost when he first did it, if I take a voice and move it up there, I can then add below a voice at normal voice level, ship them both over the same wire, at the other end, separated by a filter, and then demodulate down, and lo and behold, I can get two voices across the continent on one wire at the same time. I suppose most of you are familiar with it, but that's how it came about. The whole business came about because the telephone company wanted to make more efficient use of the wires it had. And for across the country, demodulation up and modulation down again, hey, it doesn't necessarily pay on local phone calls. But you know the trick. It's done widely. Therefore, I'm going to want a lot of filters, which I will call low pass or high pass. I either want to pass the high frequencies and stop the low frequency, get the high frequency one, or get the low one, stop the high frequency. I want to stop one or the other. That's what are called filters. Now, before that, I get into filter theory, which I'm headed for. I got to talk about least squares. Now, in principle, you people know least squares, but their experience has taught me you don't. So I'm going to assume I've got some data. At 5 equally spaced points, minus 2, minus 1, 0, 1, 2. And I want to get a straight line, least square straight line through that. And I want to replace those 5 values with the one on the curve is the smooth data point. That's my idea. So, it's not hard to do. But it's got complications. If those are the actual observations, these are the UK, I want the difference. Remember, T is only going to be at the integers, minus 2, minus 1, 0, 1, and 2. I want that difference squared, K running from minus 2 to 2, to be minimal. That is what you believe with least squares, right? And most of you believe least squares is a good thing to do. I'm not saying it is. I'm saying most of you believe least squares is a real good thing. The sum of the squares are different between the signals and this. In other words, the sum of the squares of these little distances shall be minimal. Now comes the thing you people don't understand. This minimum function is a function of A and B. The T and the K are being summed. Like T is really K, because T is going to take on the values of K. The variables are A and B. So I differentiate this minimum with respect to A and the min with respect to B. Now, if I do that, I will get 2 times the square bracket UK minus A plus BK times the derivative of A, which is minus 1, equal to 0. I can throw away those two parts. And this is summation uk is summation a plus summation b, well, b times summation t. But t was picked cleverly. Minus 2, minus 1, 0, 1, 2, so that's 0. Summation a is a constant sum 5 times. That's going to be 5a. A is going to be the average. UK all over 5. So the average of the 5 values is the best least squares estimate. And conversely, incidentally, if you want to bet, if the best estimate is the mean, then you're working in least squares. Let's do the best. Now, if instead of a linear one, I try to fit a quadratic, I would have had differential respect to A, which would be the same thing. It would be summation UK equals summation A plus B summation T K plus C summation K squared. Oh, sorry. Yes. I'll get a 2 and a minus 1 for respect to A. Oops, this. I will get this. When I differentiate respect to A, when I differentiate respect to B, I'll get summation K UK is summation K A plus B summation K squared plus C summation K cubed equals 0. Oops, sorry, not equals 0. And I will have, when I differentiate respect to C, K squared UK is K squared A plus B summation K cubed plus C summation K fourth. All the odd powers are going to drop out because I picked them symmetric. So I only have these two equations. Now I only want A. And when I do this, I will get A is 1 over 35 minus 2, or what's it, 3? I don't. Minus 2 minus 3, I forget that number. So long ago, I seem to forget these things. Minus 3, 12, 17, minus 3. Plus 12 UK minus 1 plus 17 U. U minus 2, U minus 1, U 0, plus 12 U 1 minus 3 U 2. All over 35. And the sum of the coefficients is 35. Here, I got them all 1, and this was nothing else. And U1 plus U minus 1 minus U minus 2, U minus 1, plus U0, plus U1, plus U2, each with a coefficient 5. Now, you can look at this formula as a window. This one, every one of the 5 values, I look at those 5 values, I multiply by 1/5. When I'm using this one as a window, I multiply this value by minus 3, 12, 17, 12, 3. I did it for one position. If I shift it over one, the same formula apply. So I have a window. I'm looking at the thing. The window looks at 5 values. If I want the best least squares fit straight line, I will use that window. If I want the best least squares fit for a quadratic, I will use this window. This introduces the whole idea of window. You are looking at the data through a window. You never see nature itself. It's always through a window, usually the instrument, but sometimes the window is your head, your inability to think. You impose things on what you see because you think that way, and therefore that is what you see. You never really get to see reality. There's always some kind of instrument between you and it. And it depends upon the instrument, has different characteristics. The window looks different, but you're always looking in the window. Now, if I've done it for n values, by the way, now I want to know what happens. When I put a pure frequency in those, you will find out that for the linear one, the window is going to be sine 3/2 t over 3 sine t over 2. If I took 5 points, it would be 5 there and 5 there. Take n points, 2n plus 1 point, so it would be an n there and n there. And this is window, essentially a continuous window, of what you're going to have. Those are the same numbers. When you sum up the result of putting a frequency in, you'll get this back. This is a response to the frequency, whether it's perfectly harmonic or not. This is the transfer function. This is the eigenvalue. Now, you see at t equals 0, there's a 0 here, 0 there. You say, oh, yeah, L'Hopital's rule. Let me differentiate the numerator with respect to t and the denominator, and then evaluate 0, and lo and behold, you get 1. Otherwise, you have something like this. Remember, you're only going to go out to 1/2. In t, if you want to do that way, I should make another remark. In calculus, you use radians and natural logs. In practice, you use base 10 and degrees. In field theory, you work in rotations. I have to work calculus in radians because you know why. You took calculus, you know radians are the thing that works. Because the derivative of the sine is under cosine. Any other units, the derivative of the sine has got some multiplier in front of the cosine. So that's why we use it. I've always got to shift the rotation. So by and large, I'll shift up to a half a rotation. So this is really going to be a half a rotation when I work in rotations. And this is the amount that gets through. It says, at that frequency, I get 1. That frequency, I get nothing. That frequency, I get negative. The higher ones, the ones will go like that, more and more wiggles. These, over there, will look like these, except there'll be more tangent there. They'll have about the same amount of wiggles, but there'll be much more tangent here when I fit quadratic. If I fit another one, they'll have more derivatives of the origin, nice. So the higher polynomial I fit, the more tangency I get near the origin, but I cannot avoid those wiggles. They will be there. So that is what is happening. I get these eigenvalues, which are these are the multipliers of the corresponding frequency. You give me the frequency here, I multiply by that. Now, this causes a great deal of trouble. Oh, boy. I haven't got enough time to go through it. I should have. Well, I have to do some rushing. For smoothing filters, what I did, I will find that A and a plus or minus coefficients are always the same. For a differentiator, AK, is it called, or CK, is minus C minus K. For a smoothing filter, CK equals C minus K. And this one, of course, C0 is 0. This one, C0, is arbitrary. Now, there's a fairly simple formula. F of X equals F of X plus F of minus X over 2 plus F of X minus F of minus X over 2. It's algebra your children could even do. This is an even function. This is not. Every function is a sum of an even and odd function. Every filter design is a sum of a smoothing formula and a differentiator. If I can do those two, I can do anything. Because of this very elementary formula here. Now, you know that thing. When you had Fourier series, which I'm going to have to rush through rapidly, you remember the expansion was in cosines and sines. It was in odd terms and even terms, right? Every function was a sum of even terms and odd terms. Fourier series said so. The sines were the even odd terms, the cosines were the even terms, along with cosine 0, which is 1. Sine 0 is 0. Now, I'm going to briefly go through. You remember the Fourier series, they were orthogonal. That is, if I took any one of the sines or cosines with an integer frequency, integrated over a whole period, if the two frequencies were the same, I got pi, and the two frequencies were not the same, I got 0. If I multiply sine by cosine, bound to get 0, because one odd, one's even. If I did the same with cosines, I got the same kind of thing. The difference was, at 0 frequency, I got 2 pi instead of pi, and therefore, habitually, one writes the Fourier series, f of x is a0 over 2 plus a1 cosine x plus b1 sine x plus a2 cosine 2x plus b2 sine 2x, and so on. One writes this so that the formula for calculating the a's will be exactly the same. Otherwise, You got to remember, the first one has a factor 2 removed. Nothing good about it. Now, the functions I'm going to want to do, remember, the AK and the BK are given by 1 over pi, you're going to go from 0 over minus pi to pi, we'll say, f of x cosine kx dx. And the corresponding one for sines. But since I'm going to want, for smoothing filters, I will either want to pass a frequency or stop it, this function is either 1 or 0. For a while it's 1, and for a while it's 0. There's no question that you can do those things with the most elementary calculus. If it's a differentiator, that function is x. Using integration by parts, you can do it. So there really isn't any question in practice that I will have any trouble laying my hands on those a's and b's. They're there. What I have to do and rush through is make a statement that if I expand a function in Fourier series, I get certain coefficients calculated this way. Suppose I wanted to represent the best least squares fit. What coefficient do I have? Answer, the Fourier series. Now, this is true of any orthogonal system. Orthogonal systems merely mean one function times another, multiplied by a positive weight function if you want, will give 0 if the two functions are different, will give you a number, wherever it is, when the two of them are the same. You get pi in the Fourier series, all the ones you get are the numbers. But you get very simple things. Those are frequently multiplier values. The lambdas you divide by later on. The important thing is that for any set of orthogonal functions, the best least squares fit is the Fourier series. For Fourier series. Or the equivalent calculation of Fourier coefficient for any orthogonal system. We have that very nice property, which we'll need next time. I've only touched slightly on what you do in Fourier series because I got to get started. The thing I got to remind you of least squares. And this theorem, which is sort of proved in notes, I've had to gloss over. I've also introduced this idea of a window. A window is a set of coefficients which you look at. It's zero outside. You look at the signal with those weights. That's all you see. You don't get to see the individual numbers. You only get to see a window of some width, of some shape. And don't let me worry about a window having a negative coefficient. Window is a way of speaking. That minus 3 doesn't worry me. But I say everything you do will be that way. And I will have to introduce you to quite a few things that will be explained in terms of this window business. So I got you through. But the main thing I wanted to say is how much it paid me when I got into the business. Not to go along with Kaiser and say yes, 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 but stop it. Why the frequency approach? What is this AESC? What is this? And I dragged my feet until I understood. I told you three stories that they pay off of merely understanding what the sampling theorem really was about. Now, I admit, I told you I knew Harry Nyquist to some extent. He's a nice guy. You do tend to pay more attention to results named after friends of yours. So maybe you guys laugh. Hamming is lucky he knew Harry Nyquist. But I didn't know him that well. He was in West Street and I was on Murray Hill. And I think that I had spotted, once I'd worked with John Tukey for a while, that the sampling rate was vital, that I had to understand that thoroughly, that you saw a payoff. I say this happens all the time. So I see you next week. I got something down here for something. Okay, let's go home. See you next week. Oh, sorry. Friday. There's Tuesday. Friday. 3 o'clock Friday.